Welcome to the Publix Truth event. My name is Robin Toma, and I'm Executive Director of the Los Angeles County Human Relations Commission, and I have the honor of being your MC today. This really promises to be a wonderful event today, and in particular, we owe it to an organization called the Applied Research Center for making this happen. I have the pleasure of introducing to you the Director of Applied Research Center, Gina Acebo.
Thanks, Robin. I wish I could claim I was the director of the Applied Research Center, but in fact, I'm a program director. So thank you for giving me like a raise and a kind of a new position. I think it's wonderful to see so many people today. And on behalf of the Applied Research Center, I want to thank each and every one of you for coming today to be part of what we call the Publix Truth. It has been two years, since the tragedy of September 11th. And since that time, there has been a barrage of policies, practices, and procedures that have been put in place in the name of national security. Measures like the USA Patriot Act, the Student and Exchange Visitor Information System, Operation Tarmac, the Absconder Apprehension Initiative, the Terrorist Information Prevention System, the National Security Entry-Exit Registration System, the Total Information Awareness Initiative. All of these measures have been enacted with minimal public debate, minimal public scrutiny, and yet they now serve as a foundation for how the United States wants to define national security. At the Applied Research Center, our instincts told us otherwise, actually, that these measures have actually only ratcheted up the level of racial intolerance that we know already permeates within our society. We believe that the measures come at tremendous costs to our communities, and that what they do is actually increase the level of racial discrimination and profiling that will take place now in our society. We felt we had to make a case for otherwise. For the last 20 months, we've been traveling around the country speaking with individuals and communities and organizations about how their lives have changed since the enactment of the War on Terrorism policies. And slowly, cautiously, courageously, people have shared their stories with us. But what they have painted is an appalling and frightening and maddening picture. For example, in Mississippi, Pakistani jewelry kiosk owners had their businesses shut down by the FBI and the INS as they were swept through local markets and accusing their families and their businesses of supporting so-called terrorist activity, but without any evidence except to be under suspicion because of their country of origin. In Oregon, immigrant Latino workers fell subject to the INS's organized sting operations at their work sites. And in rural Kentucky, immigrant workers were subject to early morning home raids, resulting in immediate deportation. In Texas, the federal sweeps post 9/11 had indiscriminately rounded up so many people that authorities fashioned giant meat cages as makeshift detention cells for people that were charged with no specific crimes, but brought in for investigation for the suspicion of their national origin. In California, community activists working on racial justice issues, immigrant rights, peace issues, found themselves subject to voluntary interviews with the FBI, which assessed their political activities, their religious beliefs, and their personal histories. And in states across the country, like Illinois, Georgia, New York, immigrant families are struggling through the immigration web. They're finding that their paperwork is backlogged with an inept system of the INS, and that what they find themselves then are accused of frauding the system, and then presented with a sole choice of deportation, thus separating them from their loved ones and their livelihoods with little recourse or due process. These stories are critical for us to know about because what they demonstrate is what is inherently wrong and discriminatory about so-called anti-terrorism policies that are often just anti-immigrant measures in disguise. That's why we're here today. That's why we're here to listen to the public's truth, to have members of our communities share their stories, share their truth on how their lives have been changed by these policies, and to actually challenge other folks' stories, like Attorney General Ashcroft, who's been on tour for the U.S. Patriot Act, promoting the effectiveness of the Patriot Act, but knowing good and well, if he heard the stories that we had to tell, that the effectiveness of those policies are tearing families apart, are creating and contributing to a climate of fear, and of working and wreaking havoc and hatred that's led to job loss and injury and the threat of death, which we'll hear about today. For many of our cultures, storytelling has been an integral part to understanding our histories, but it's also been a place to inspire us for action. Today, here at the Public's Truth, we ask all of you to acknowledge, to be witness to these stories, and that these stories are not in any way, shape, or form isolated events, but they are representative of what is happening to thousands of people across the country. As witnesses, let us make and take these stories as our public record today. Let us take into consideration the words of justice that a Native American writer, Leslie Marmon Silko, wrote. I'll tell you something about stories. They aren't just entertainment. Don't be fooled. They're all we have, you see. All we have to fight off illness and death. You don't have anything if you don't have the stories. The evils is mighty, but it can't stand up to our stories. I thank the courageous steps of our testifiers today, and I thank you for being part of the Public's Truth.
Thank you, Gina. Several weeks ago, when I was approached by Francis Calpatura of the Applied Research Center to take a look at this event, about what they had done in Northern California, I listened to him and I thought to myself, this is an event we must have in Los Angeles County. We, in this county, since September 11th and before, have, of course, enjoyed some of the greatest diversity that this probably any community in the world has ever experienced. But we've also experienced an unprecedented amount of hate and discrimination. And from the Commission's perspective, when we receive the reports from law enforcement as well as community-based organizations about hate crimes and hate incidents, when we see the incredible number of hate crimes that took place in a short time after September 11th that reached a record number, was 1,200% higher than the previous year. That was the highest total in the country for any county. That was the highest that had ever been recorded by any jurisdiction. We know that we are facing something much more serious because what we are seeing with hate crimes was just the tip of the iceberg. Below the hate crimes, there are many, many acts of hate and discrimination which go on every day that don't get recorded. There are many victims, not only of hate, but of discrimination in the realm of our public policies, in our private spheres of life. Even while driving on the freeway, people find themselves stared at, harassed, yelled at, simply because they may wear a headscarf or look Middle Eastern or Muslim. The Commission has been focused on trying to bring together those stories, and shortly after September 11th, we held a meeting, in fact, not far from this place at the First AME Church, where we collected and heard many of the reports that were happening around the county. And since that time, we've been alerted through the paper and through calls about the number of different incidents that people have suffered through, whether it's because of the special registration program or because of Operation Tarmac or the Social Security No Match program, any number of related initiatives that have come from September 11th. And while I should say that we have seen at the same time, in many ways, an unprecedented outpouring of support for many of the communities that have been affected, I don't want to downplay that. I recall still the day of September 13th hearing from many of the Islamic centers, the number of phone calls they had received of support, far outnumbering those that they had received that spewed hate and threatened them. But despite that, we know that there is a real danger we're facing here. We're in a climate when people are so scared for their lives when they hear about us going to, say, an elevated level of alert. And they're asking us, President or the Attorney General, whoever, that we need to be suspicious of any unusual activity, to be on the lookout for any suspicious activity. And unfortunately, in so many people's minds, that leads to a focus on immigrants, on people who may wear turbans because they're Sikhs, on women who wear headscarves because they're Muslim, on people who simply look different. And there were a large number of people, not only Muslims and Middle Easterners, but many who are Latino, who are South Asian, who are Sikh, who all were victimized after September 11th. We clearly need to change the culture so that concern for security does not translate into discrimination, does not translate into stereotyping. And unfortunately, the different stories that we hear from time to time in the newspaper or on the news don't necessarily come pieced together so that we can see the whole picture. And I think that's the power of today's event, because you will see and you will hear today the stories of people who have suffered in all these different realms because of these policies, because of stereotyping and prejudice and bigotry. And with that, I truly hope that we all have the opportunity to reflect, just as our witnesses will do, and come to some conclusion about what we can do in our own world to make sure we don't end up in a place that we don't want to be. We have today for you some very powerful testimonies. Some of these people will be speaking in public for the first time about their experience. And I want to say that it takes a lot of courage to have to go through a very painful experience. And I really want to ask for your support and your admiration for these witnesses. Also, we have key witnesses who we've asked, they're public officials, some are elected officials, some are people who hold posts of leadership in our community. And their role is to hear the stories, to reflect on them, and we're asking them particularly to take action. With that, I want to introduce the first set of testimonies, which is going to be focused on post-9/11 policies and the climate which make these possible. They have had a true impact on people's lives, as you will hear, and this first set of testimonies will show you why that is a fact. And I'll begin with calling Ms. Ban Alwardi.
Good afternoon. I want to start with a set of questions that my family was confronted with. How do you feel about the war? What are your opinions on the war? Do you support Saddam Hussein? Are you a Shiite or a Sunni? Do you know anybody from Hezbollah operating in the U.S.? How about Hamas? Are you trained to use a weapon? Are you trained to fly a plane? Do you know anyone who wants to harm the U.S. in any way? If you do know people who want to commit a terrorist act in the United States, would you report them? These questions were asked of almost 11,000 Iraqi Americans in a period of 4 weeks before and during the invasion of Iraq. Who asked these questions? The FBI. Sometimes joined by the INS, sometimes joined by local police officers. The FBI came to my home right before the war. They wanted to speak to my family because we were Iraqi, not because we were being investigated for any kind of crime, not because we violated some kind of law. No, we were being interrogated because we were Iraqi. They were very clear about that. On the Sunday afternoon, right before the war began, two federal FBI agents knocked on our front door, totally unannounced. They held, both of them, very big files in their hands, and they were also escorted by the police. I knew this because I saw the police car parked outside in front of our house, and so did the rest of our neighborhood. I answered the door that day. Only my mom and I were home that day, actually. The agents came into our living room, and they asked for my father. I asked them who they were. They told us that they were with the FBI and that they were here to protect us and to build better relations with our community and to protect us from hate crimes. I asked them for a warrant. They asked to come in again. They were looking for my father, like I said, to ask questions. He was at work at the time. They looked at my mother and I suspiciously as though we were trying to hide something, as though we were trying to hide my father somewhere behind the door. And my mom blurted out, you know, we've lived here for 30 years. We're U.S. citizens. They simply asked when my father would return. They gave us about an hour to wait for my father to come back or to meet us, or to meet him, actually, in his office, which is in Alhambra. When my mother offered to give him the address of his office, they said, no, don't worry, ma'am, we know where it is. So they asserted their power very clearly right then. Exactly 1 hour later, there we were, two FBI agents, me and my father. I was representing my father. I'm an attorney. He was my most important client in my life, right then, especially. They pulled out his file. They opened it up, and there we saw his photograph, a recent photograph, his signature, all of his immigration documents for the last 30 years, his tax documents, everything that he could have ever had in that file. Then the questioning began. Where were you born? What was your father's name and your grandfather's name? Do you own any weapons? Do you own weapons of mass destruction, like chemical poison or lethal gas? Do you know anyone with access to weapons like this? Have you ever taken flight school courses, or have you ever flown a plane? Do you know any Iraqi Americans living in the U.S. now who do fly planes? When was the last time you went to Iraq? Do you consider Iraq your home? Where is home for you? Would you bear arms to fight for this country? The interview lasted almost 2 hours. The agents also asked me questions. Why does your father need an attorney? They asked. Who else do you represent? Have any of your clients been deported before? Before they left, they told us that the interviews that they have conducted with other Iraqi Americans have been a very positive experience for them, and that they really started to like Iraqis through this exchange. My father thanked them for their visit. He was very friendly. He shook both of their hands, and they were gone. Finally, they were gone. I guess we weren't so shocked by this visit because it actually had been happening to so many of the community members at the time, and so many of my own clients, actually. And we had kind of experienced something very similar to this in 1991 when Iraq was first invaded. At the time, though, the FBI would just basically park their car outside of our home or park their car outside of my dad's office. Our phones were all wired. Our mail was coming to our house delivered open in plastic bags for weeks on end. But this time it was very different because they actually entered our home and they came in asking such personal questions about our beliefs, our faith, our loyalties, without a reason except for the fact that we were Iraqi. And we really, really felt like suspects. I felt like constantly they were looking for something that we were trying to hide from them. It was even more difficult because everything I learned in law school about the Fourth Amendment, searches and seizures, the Constitution as it stands, was literally out the window. But what was worse? So many times in my mind I was thinking, what is happening to non-citizens? What are happening to immigrants who are undocumented? How are they being treated? Well, I was there when literally hundreds every day were being arrested at the INS during the registration process that Mr. Thomas spoke about earlier, and Sears. We watched. I was representing so many clients who were being shackled in handcuffs, bound together, marched through the corridors of the INS, arrested en masse, all because of their nationality, all because of their race. Now these immigrants face deportation in the thousands. Some have escaped to Canada, begging for asylum, escaping from persecution in the United States. Some stay in America fighting for their lives, for their families, begging immigration judges to just give them some more time so their papers can be processed. But I want everyone to know that this is not the first time that immigrants have been scapegoated and targeted by the government. Immigrants from all over the world have a long history of being persecuted, discriminated, harassed, and hated. Now Arab, Muslim, and South Asian immigrants have become the other. We've become the foreigners, the sleeper cells waiting to strike from within. Evildoers, as the president put so bluntly, these are the human costs of national security. This is the war on terrorism that has terrorized our communities and my family for too long. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Alwardi. I wanted to also mention that she is an attorney who in Los Angeles who specializes in immigration law, as you might have gathered from her testimony. But she's also the president of the Anti-American Arab Discrimination Committee here in Los Angeles and Orange County.
The American Arab
Anti-Discrimination
Committee, not
the American Arab Anti... Oh, right. That's absolutely... I knew that. And now we have a leader in the Sikh community, someone who I've had the pleasure to work with for some time now, since September 11th, and someone who I think will give you a sense of what the Sikh community has suffered during this time, and that's Narinjan Singh Khalsa.
Good afternoon. On September 15th, 2001, a Sikh was in front of his convenience store in Mesa, Arizona, planting flowers, when a man drove up, uttered a racial epithet, and shot him to death. "I'm a patriot," police reports quoted the man as saying shortly after his arrest on the day of the shootings. He added that he was standing up for his brothers and sisters in New York. Since September 11th, simply because of our religiously mandated appearance, thousands of Sikhs across America have been assaulted, harassed, discriminated against on a wholesale basis, and I'm sorry to say, several more have been shot and seriously wounded, and three more have been killed. There are really no words to describe the true senselessness of these actions. There is no group of Americans more democratic and patriotic than the Sikh community. Sikhs are not Muslims, they're not Christians, they're not Jews, and they're not Hindus or Buddhists, they're Sikhs. If this is the way we're going to act as Americans, the terrorists really don't need to do much more. Our own ignorance, fear, and hatred will end up destroying America from the inside out. We won't win the war on terrorism by becoming worse than the terrorists themselves. These psychopaths did not attack us as individuals. They attacked us for our beliefs and for what we stand for. Do you know what they hate and fear about us the most? Our freedom, our tolerance and respect for each other, and our right to express ourselves religiously, socially, and personally however we choose. Hate is not something that makes America great. Hate and ignorance weakens America and undermines everything we stand for. Now, I think we know all these things. These are issues we think about every day, and probably most of the people in this room really aspire to the higher ideals of America. But there's a tremendous undercurrent in this country caused by the fear and hatred after 9/11, which has made a lot of people really kind of trample on everything that America stands for. The responsibility for solving this problem lies with everybody. Everybody here, it lies with me, it lies with you. And if anybody who sits now and listens to a hateful epithet, who sees somebody discriminated against and does nothing, becomes part of the problem, not part of the solution. I got to know Robin, and I've been doing a lot since 9/11/2001, simply because it was too painful not to, as a human being. And everybody needs to feel the pain of what everybody's going through in this country, or we're going to watch America slip away before we know it. Thank you.
Sneaky Narinian. And now we have Rashid Alam, a 19-year-old Lebanese-American student who experienced something in Yorba Linda in February of this year. And I'll let him speak more about that. Rashid?
Hi. Like he said, my name is Rashid Alam. I'm a Lebanese American, born here. I'm 19 years old, going to FJC right now. And on February 22nd of this year, I was racially attacked by a large group of white men and severely beaten. They're not charged for their crimes, for a hate crime. They're charged for what they did, but not a hate crime. And it's sad to me, but that's what's happening. And, you know, they ran out their cars, just ripping off their shirts and swinging baseball bats and golf clubs, screaming out, you know, sand niggers and F Arabs and Iraqis, even though no one there was even close to Iraqi. And, you know, it was during the time of the war, so, you know, it was a pretty scary thing, and, you know, some of the people got away, some didn't. I was one that didn't get away, and they severely beat me hard, and, you know, I got a couple of stabbing wounds, and they just jumped on my face, and, I mean, literally tried to kill me, I believe. And I was very close. I mean, I'm lucky to be talking to you guys right now. I mean, the doctor told me that I was lucky to be at least not blind because of so much trauma that I had back of the back of my head. So, you know, I'm just here to try to change some people, you know. So just trying to let you guys know that if you see somebody different, somebody not like you, he's not weird, because no one's normal, you know, everyone's different, so don't try to look like somebody else, don't, you know, just be your own person, and that's just what you gotta do. See, there's a lot of different people here, different faces, no one's the same, and, you know, just we gotta love, that's it.
Thank you, Rashid. When I read about that event in the newspaper, I could hardly believe it, and I really do want to recognize the tremendous effort it takes for someone who's gone through such a horrific experience to be before us. And unfortunately, that kind of incident was repeated hundreds of times after 9/11 here in LA County. Now we have Mr. Arnold Lugo. He's someone who was working at Los Angeles Airport at the time of at the time when Operation Tarmac was taking place, and I'll ask him to come up and speak to you now.
Good afternoon. Somebody's going to translate my English because my English is very short. Okay? Excuse me for it. Soy Harold Lugo.
My name is Harold Lugo.
Procedente de Colombia, Sudamérica.
I'm from Colombia in South America.
No he escrito ningún diálogo, ninguna cosa especial.
I'm not here to talk about anything special, a dialogue with you.
Okay, I don't write any special thing. I'm going to talk from the bottom of my heart. Voy a hablar desde el fondo de mi corazón.
I'm going to talk from deep from my heart.
La razón por la que me encuentro en este país.
The reason why I'm in this country today.
Es la misma razón por la que están aquí todos los obreros emigrantes.
Is the same reason why there are many immigrant workers in this country today.
Busca de una vida más digna para nuestros hijos, para nuestras esposas.
We're looking for a more dignified life for our families and for our wives.
Esto me obligó a mí a salir de mi país y dejar mis raíces, dejar mi gente, dejar a mis hijos, dejar a mi esposa con muchísimo dolor.
With a lot of pain, I left my wife and my family, my community, my roots, and my country.
Tuve que luchar mucho para poder obtener un grado de educación.
I had to struggle a lot to obtain the level of education that I have right now.
Para poderle dar felicidad, bienestar, estabilidad, vida digna a mis hijos.
To obtain a life that's stable and with dignity.
Por eso me vine aquí a este país, porque en mi país no se puede vivir con $2 en un día de trabajo.
That's why I came to this country, because I couldn't live on $2 a day in my home country.
Por eso también están la mayoría de los emigrantes pobres aquí en este país.
And that's why there are many poor immigrants in this country. That's why they came.
Me vine de Colombia esperando, con la esperanza de que iba a transformar mi hogar, iba a darles una vida digna, buena educación, ropa, diversión o distracción a mis hijos.
I came to this country with the hope that I would live a more dignified life, better education for my kids, have more fun, live a life that I've always wanted.
También para sentirme mejor, para poder ayudar mejor a la sociedad.
So that I could also better the society as well.
Trabajé en muchísimas compañías donde tuve experiencias positivas y negativas.
I worked for many different countries, companies, and there were many positive and negative experiences.
Dentro de esas experiencias, en algunas compañías, por ejemplo, me mandaban a robar.
In many instances, I worked for companies that stole from me.
Oyeron a robar.
They stole from me.
Ellos me enviaban a mí a robar para ellos.
They told me to steal for them.
¿Verdad?
It's the truth.
Ahora, empecé y tuve un accidente muy grave.
I had a very tragic accident.
Perdí parcialmente la memoria.
I lost part of my memory.
Estuve a punto de quedar en una silla de ruedas.
¿Otra vez?
Estuve a punto de quedar en una silla de ruedas.
Okay. I was almost at the point that I had to be in a wheelchair on a permanent basis.
Pero luché porque no me gusta ser una carga para nadie, porque me gusta ser autosuficiente, porque en lugar de ser una carga, yo quiero ser un alivio, una ayuda.
And I struggled very hard so that I wouldn't be the responsibility of somebody else, but that I could be self-determinate on my own.
Entonces, ¿cuál es la razón por la que yo estoy aquí? ¿Para hacer daño? ¿Para destruir? ¿O para levantar a mis hijos que los veía con hambre, con angustia? Después de estar trabajando 12 horas a veces al día para recibir $3-4 en un día de trabajo fuerte.
I'm not here to cause any destruction, to destroy people's lives, but that I'm here so that my kids don't have to live in anguish, they don't have to live in poverty, and they can have dignity. And then I work many, many hours for not a lot of pay.
Con todas las limitaciones, las imposibilidades físicas, y no puedo decir psicológicas o mentales, después de los accidentes y los sacrificios que pasé, logré muchas cosas pequeñas para mí que no he podido desarrollar.
With all my physical limitations, be that psychological or whatever, that I have been able to gain small things for myself.
Aquí en Norteamérica se habla con papeles.
In North America, we talk with papers. We talk about papers.
Nosotros tenemos que mostrar algo, si no, no nos creen.
We have to show them something, show them a piece of paper so that they believe us.
Entonces, como mi tiempo está muy corto,
because my time is so short,
solamente les voy a mostrar unas cuantas cosas.
I'm going to tell you about a little something.
Estos son certificados que yo he obtenido aquí en los Estados Unidos.
These are certificates that I've received since coming to this country.
Muchos certificados religiosos.
Many certificates that are for religious aspects.
Muchas cartas de felicitación y cosas de felicitación de las escuelas por colaborar con los estudiantes que no podían hacer sus tareas bien o tenían problemas de lectura o problemas en sus casas con sus familiares, con sus padres.
Okay. Many certificates congratulating them for job well done in school, for participating as a parent, helping their kids, various community activities he's received certificates for. Certificates of appreciation for completing specific programs in the community.
Cartas de recomendación de la iglesia, de las compañías de donde he trabajado.
Letters of recommendation from his local churches.
Todo esto porque simplemente yo deseaba realizarme, hacer algo bueno para mí, para mis hijos.
All because I wanted to accomplish something for my kids.
Preparar el terreno para que esas semillas pudieran crecer y dar fruto.
So that I could prepare and cultivate the seed so that they could learn something, so that they could be a part of something.
Ustedes ven papeles y papeles aquí.
All these papers here.
Son de ir a estudiar.
They were also the places where I studied.
Tratar de aprender el idioma para poderme comunicar y dar lo mejor de mí a la sociedad, a la gente que me rodeaba.
Right, to learn English so that I could communicate clearly to the people that I was in.
Esos son los papeles que yo tengo míos.
These are all the papers that I have.
Aquí también tengo más de mi esposa.
And these are also the papers of my wife.
Certificados de educación de ella.
Different educational certificates, the Red Cross.
También ha podido, ha servido en las iglesias, en las escuelas.
Certificates from churches and local schools.
Okay. Entonces, ¿qué sucede? ¿Somos un mal para este país?
So, what does that mean? Are we bad for this country? Are we doing something wrong?
Yo puedo hacer el mismo bien que hago aquí en mi país.
I could do the same good in my own country.
Pero no puedo sobrevivir ni darle a mis hijos la alimentación, la educación, con el dinero que se gana allá.
But I can't provide food and education in my own country.
Las condiciones con que se vive de guerra, de hambre, de miseria.
Due to the climate of war and the other things that are going on in my country politically.
Estos son los papeles de mi historia médica de los accidentes que tuve de trabajo.
These are incident reports of all the injuries that I sustained because of my jobs.
Okay. Antes de entrar a trabajar en el aeropuerto y ser perseguido por inmigración.
While I was working at the airport, I was persecuted while I was working at the airport.
Mi vida era un desastre, muy estrecha, con muchísimas necesidades.
My life was turned upside down.
Después de esto, es peor, es un infierno.
My life, because of it, has turned to hell. It's gone out of control.
Yo era security, estaba feliz de mi trabajo. ¿Por qué? Porque podía servir diariamente cientos de personas, miles de personas. Después del 11 de septiembre que llegaban angustiadas, amargadas, perdidas, desorientadas, llorando, con su equipaje perdido, con 3-4 días sin comer en los aeropuertos que habían cerrado. Gente que no había cómo atenderles, cómo darles a ellos lo que necesitaban. Una sonrisa, un abrazo, un aliento.
He didn't know what to do. There were hundreds of people in the airport being detained. They hadn't eaten, being persecuted. They didn't know what to do. They couldn't even know how to support each other, give each other smiles. It was chaos in the airport.
Y recibí felicitaciones de las compañías aéreas donde trabajaba, para las que trabajaba.
And that I received, otra vez, por favor.
De las compañías para las que trabajaba.
Mm-hmm. For the companies that we did work for.
Después de eso, simplemente me llegó una carta, me detuvieron, me metieron a la cárcel, me pusieron cadenas, me mandaron al médico, a hacerme test de drogas, me mandaron donde el psicólogo, todavía no he podido resolver mi cuestión migratoria, etcétera.
So, and because of this,
they send me to take a drug test.
Drug test, psychological test. They put him in jail. All these things that he was targeted for just for working at the airport.
Y por ese accidente de trabajo fue que yo perdí parte de mi memoria y no puedo hablarles un inglés adecuado. Muchísimas gracias a todos ustedes. Dios bendiga a América, una América justa, una América para todos.
God bless the just America.
Gracias, señor Lugo. Thank you very much. The rest of the story is that, to sum it up, is despite the length of time that Mr. Lugo was working at the airport, he and as many other immigrant employees have been subjected to intense scrutiny and he has been fired, detained, and deported for minor visa violations and immigration status issues. And since that time, he's been unable to find employment. And this is part of the Operation Tarmac that INS has carried out. At this time, we're going to enjoy a moment of music and an opportunity to reflect on what we've heard so far, and we'll return with testimonies in a moment. We're just taking a moment. It'll be about another 45 seconds. Thank you, Mike Fonte, for the beautiful music. We're now going to begin with a sick. It's okay to applaud. We're now going to begin with the second set of testimonies. And what this is about is that the policies and climate in the post 9/11 period aren't new. They have had historical roots, and they have drawn from and bleed into other kinds of institutional racism that exist. And we're now going to hear stories from individuals who have experienced racial profiling of the old and of the new type. And we're going to begin with Victor Flores.
How's everyone doing? All right. Well, what I'm about to speak on right now is racial profiling and the gang injunction. And basically, you know what? This is on my life. This isn't something that you read in like a bulletin or see something that you see in a movie or anything like that. This is something that's been taking place for the last past 5 years of my life. And it and, you know, there's thousands and thousands of kids that this happened to. Where do I start? The California definition of a gang: any gang of three or more people acting together to commit a crime. The criteria to be a gang is basically if you wear baggy clothes, if you have a shaved head, that's what the police officers go by. If you're young, if you wear, you know, certain clothes, if you're people of color. At the age of 11, I brought a firecracker to school, and I was not only expelled from my school, my middle school, but I was also expelled from the LAUSD. At the age of 11, I've been going through continuation school, trying to find my way back into a regular school. At the age of 11, I've been on probation up until now. At the age of 11, I lost my right to a search and seizure, and my house was raided. And sure enough, they found a picture of me and my brother. My brother is from a neighborhood, and they associated me with my brother. So at the age of 11, I've been on the gang database. My condition papers went from a stack of 3 condition papers to a stack of 11 conditions I have to follow by. 11 conditions of papers. And you see, when you're put on the gang database, you know, you don't have the right to appeal, so they don't notify you. Supposedly, if you don't have no contact with the police, which means that if you don't get stopped for a traffic violation, a broken tail light, etc., then, you know, everything's cool and they let you off in 5 years. So you have to have no contact with the police in 5 years. I have not heard one case where someone got a letter in the mail saying that, you know what, you're off the gang database. They don't tell you when you're on the gang database, and they don't tell you when you're off the gang database. There's no time, you can't appeal it, you're not notified. With being on the gang database, it leads to constant stops by the police, constant. If you're stopped, you know, with a group of other known gang members or other people on probation, then that's a violation and you go to jail. And, you know, I'm 11 years old. I have family that, you know, are from neighborhoods that are on probation. So I can't go to a party with my family. I couldn't go to my dad's funeral because, you know, I'm on probation and the police threatened me, said that I couldn't go. You know, I mean, just because my brother or my dad or my uncle or anybody else, you know, there's that little conflict right there. Once you're on the gang file, or even if you fit the police description of a gang member, you can expect constant, I can't explain to you, I can't stress on you, constant police stops. If they run your name, then they ask many questions, and if you slip once, then that's it. It's done. You know, it matters who you're with, or where you're at, and what are you doing. Like a story, you know, I was accused of committing vandalism late at night. I was with a couple of people. The other couple of people walked off, and because, you know, I was underage, at the time I was only 14 years old, the police officer drove me from Venice, California to East Los Angeles in the Hazard Park, which is a notorious gang-infested park, and dropped me off. And that was it. He said, get the hell out of my car. And that was the end of it. I had to find my own way home. All because I was on probation. Because I was supposedly from the rival neighborhood. You also get constant harassment in school. There's what you call police officials, which is basically a police officer on school 24/7 or when school's in progress. They also have contact with the police. They also know all the kids that are on probation. They pull you out of class when you're on probation. They search your bags. They search everything that's on you. They take out your socks. They make you open your mouth, go around your waistband. It's a constant thing in school. If you think, you know, school's a safe place, it's not. Because they have cops on school going through the kids' pockets, through their notebooks, pulling out papers out of their notebooks, thinking they're hiding, you know, drugs or whatever, you know? Me, personally, I saw a fight break out in school. I broke it up because I was the only one on probation, because I was the only one on color. I spent 3 months in juvenile hall. That's where I ran into the Youth Justice Coalition. That's where I became a youth organizer. My charges were acquitted because they had no evidence. Supposedly, I was fighting an assault with a deadly weapon. All the charges were acquitted because everyone said, you know, I just broke up with a fight with an open fist, and that was it. And I don't know what else to say. Man, like, you know, ever since 11 years old, I've been on probation. I was supposed to get off probation in July, you know. I've been waiting for this moment for 5 years. 5 years, you know, ever since 11 years old. And, like, you know, July, they told me, you know, we got to come back next month because we forgot your papers. And sure enough, it went from next month that my probation officer messed up, and he forgot my papers at the office. And then it went to August. And sure enough, they backed it up another 2 months. So now here I am, you know. And now I have to wait till October. And it's like, man, you know, when is this going to end? When is it going to end? I've been waiting for this moment for 5 years. 5 years. Ever since 11, trying to get off the gang database and trying to get off everything. Trying to worry about conditions. And they just won't let me go. Just won't let me go. But I just want to say right now that, you know, I can sit up here and talk all I want, you know, and talk all I want. That's all they say. That's all the people on the other side of the line say, is that all we do is talk and talk and talk. But with the talking, I come with solutions. And the solutions that I want is basically, you know, over there on that right-hand corner and on that table, we have a packet. And maybe if you don't have the packet already, you can go over there and check out the solutions. But I'm going to let you know on some of them. If you come out of the jail or whatever, the prison or whatever, you want people automatically off for probation because you paid your debt to society or paid your debt to, you know, whoever. We also want known gang members and et cetera to go through workshops to work their way off probation, to work their way off the gang database. We want to be notified when you're on the gang database. We want to be able to appeal it. The reason we can't appeal it is because it's a civil court order. There's no way we can appeal it. We want to have a lawyer. We want to be represented by a lawyer. But, yeah, that's it. Thank you.
Thank you, Victor. Victor works with a group called Youth Justice LA, a youth coalition that's working hard to organize youth in the Valley and around the county to challenge the kinds of policies that seem to track so many of our young people from schools into the prisons. And unfortunately, the racial profiling you spoke of is something that is very much akin in many ways to the kind of profiling we've seen after 9/11. Basically is the facile solution for some in law enforcement to simply be able to determine what people are or what they do based on the way they appear. So I appreciate his honesty and forthrightness of coming forward today. Next, we have someone who can tell us about the kind of discrimination and profiling that occurs in housing. And that person is Marlene Garza, a lawyer with the Housing Rights Center representing 13 tenants who have sued their apartment owner. And I'll let her tell more about that.
At the Housing Rights Center, we work to guarantee that all people are able to live in their homes without discrimination on the basis of their race, national origin, religion, or other protected characteristics. In the wake of September 11th, reports of harassment and violence against immigrant communities were widespread, and this was no different in the housing arena. Federal and state fair housing laws prohibit landlords and their managers from discrimination based on national origin and religion, including refusals to rent, evictions, harassment, demands for birthplace and national origin information, and discriminatory statements. Any such acts or policies or statements are a violation of the civil rights of the tenant or applicant. The Housing Rights Center has investigated and litigated several cases where landlords or their managers violated the civil rights of their tenants because of concerns, fears, and even hatred based on national origin and religion in the heels of September 11th. Here are two such cases. First, on July 31st of this year, HRC and 13 tenants obtained a widely reported preliminary injunction against Donald Sterling Beverly Hills Properties. Sterling, who owns over 100 large apartment complexes in Los Angeles, claimed that after the terrorist attacks, he needed to learn whether any of his tenants in his buildings were foreign nationals. So he demanded birthplace information from tenants and applicants. We argued this violated the tenants' fair housing and civil rights. The federal judge assigned to the case called Sterling's justification a sham and ordered Sterling and his three businesses to stop asking or requiring any of such information. This case involves many more allegations of discrimination and racist tenant selection and is scheduled for trial in August of next year. Second, HRC and the South Asian Network are currently investigating a case where a Pakistani Muslim male was harassed and thrown out of his home just weeks after the terrorist attacks. After September 11th, this client reports having his vehicle broken into, living in a hostile environment, with hate speech about Islam and against persons of Middle Eastern origin, and fearing for his physical being and personal property on a daily basis. When he asked the property manager to intervene, he was advised to just move, and subsequently was served with an eviction notice which cited the tensions in the Middle East as the reason. This is like so many scenarios we've seen. Our client feels a tremendous sense of insecurity. He has lived in the United States for over 20 years and reports that nothing like this has ever happened to him before. For the first time, he feels like he doesn't belong, that he has been ostracized, labeled as a terrorist, and made to feel like a traitor to this country. He describes seeing distrust in people's faces, and that's something he's never known until now. This is all the more troubling, of course, because this harassment is occurring in his home, the one place we all expect to feel safe and secure. In light of cases like these, it's critical for residents to report discrimination and harassment in their housing. Statistics that measure reporting show that only 1% of all discriminatory housing practices are reported. Immigrants might be especially hesitant to assert their civil rights, not wanting to draw any unnecessary attention to themselves or to their families. But through forums like this one, we can raise awareness of this problem and make it possible for all those affected to come forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Marlene.